Hello there. Today is Friday, July 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, anguish and outrage over two fatal police shootings in 2 days.
When people say Black Lives Matter, that doesn't mean blue lives don't matter. It just means all lives matter.
The FBI director gets grilled by Republicans over his decision not to prosecute Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump meets with Republican lawmakers Thursday in Washington. North Korea declares war against the United States, and also ahead, Mother Teresa, a symbol of love for all humanity, on her way to sainthood. It's all on today's International Edition. There is growing outrage and protests across the United States over the shooting death of a Black man by a Minnesota police officer after the man's fiancée, Diamond Reynolds, used Facebook live stream to document what happened.
As he's reaching for his back pocket wallet, he lets the officer know, "Officer, I have a firearm on me." I begin to yell, but he's licensed to carry. After that, he began to take off shots. But, don't move. But how can you not move when you're asking for license and registration? It's either you want my hands in the air or you want my information and my identification.
32-year-old Philandro Castile was killed after a policeman pulled over the vehicle he was driving. The video has gone viral worldwide. It came one day after police killed a 37-year-old Black man in the southern city of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. President Obama commented on the events shortly after arriving in Poland for a NATO summit Thursday.
When people say Black Lives Matter, that doesn't mean blue lives don't matter. It just means all lives matter. But right now, the big concern is the fact that the data shows Black folks are more vulnerable to these kinds of incidents.
The president said all Americans should be concerned about the problem with frequent police shootings of Black people, which he called symptomatic of a broader set of racial disparities than exist in the U.S. justice system. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton, meanwhile, is calling for an independent federal investigation and says he doesn't believe Castile would have been treated the way he was had he been white.
I can't say how seriously I take this. I can't say how shocked I am and how deeply, deeply offended that this would occur in Minnesota to somebody who got pulled over for a taillight being out of order.
Frederick Mello, a reporter at the St. Paul Pioneer Press, talked to VOA's David Byrd about the mood there in Minnesota following the death of Castile.
I think kind of all eyes are focused right now on this case just because it has gained national attention and the video went viral so quickly. I think around 10 p.m. last night it already had a million views on Facebook. So people are talking about this kind of coast-to-coast case. It's hard, less than 24 hours after the news in Louisiana hit about a fatal police shooting, to kind of be coupled with that incident, which was also very graphic. And certainly the family's continuing to speak out. So it's a pretty somber situation.
Now, there's been some misunderstanding online about what the exact Minnesota law is about concealed carry. Fernando Castillo, the victim in this case, had a permit to carry a firearm and had the firearm in the car with him. And according to the video that was published, told the police that he had that firearm. Has this caused any kind of consternation in Minnesota over, you know, is it safe to carry your firearm anymore?
You know, it's interesting because we have a pretty conservative readership at the Pioneer Press. And after incidents of police encounters going bad hit the press, the comments at the end of articles tend to run along the line of, well, if he had cooperated with the police, well, if he hadn't been misbehaving. This case is different. Even some of those kind of comments at the end of the article were, wow, looks like a mistake was made. If he identified that he was a permitted gun holder and that he had a gun on him and he was asked to show his ID, as the girlfriend maintains in the video, then he wasn't really doing anything wrong. And in fact, he was just complying step by step with the officer. Now, we don't see on the video the moments leading up to the shooting, but we just see her kind of calm, composed rendition of the facts. And the officer's obvious distress. So, yeah, I think it will be a little bit of a different discussion here. This wasn't a person who was clearly running away from anything. There was no kind of act of violence here. We've gone through his police record at the Pioneer Press, and it's really focused on things like parking tickets. He was clearly not a felon, and he was really beloved at his job.
That's one thing I've seen in several media reports, is that Fernando Castillo was actually quite beloved, not only by the parents of the school at which he worked, but also by the children.
About 4 in the morning outside of the governor's mansion, kind of a thin white man approaches me and says, I'm not with Black Lives Matter. I'm not, you know, one of these activists. I'm actually a landlord. I own commercial buildings in the city. I can't stop crying. And I said, well, how did you know this man? And the landlord said, I have a son named Elias. He was terrified of walking through the lunch line. So he's in pre-kindergarten. Every day I'd drive to school. At noon, I'd walk him through the lunch line. And Philando, as the kitchen supervisor at this Montessori school, would be on the other side of the line saying, hey, you can do it. Here's some apple juice. Here's some milk. Let me help you with that. This wasn't just an innocent man in the eyes of the community. This was a good man. And that makes this case especially tragic.
Well, the officer involved has been placed on administrative, paid administrative leave, and we're also now, at this hour, hearing reports that a protest in Dallas, Texas, has turned violent and multiple police officers have been shot. Well, considering the shooting was brought to light through social media, it's no surprise that it's gone viral. Here to talk more about that is VOA's G. Abby Lee. G, this is really creating a lot of reaction.
It's really creating a lot of reaction on Absolutely. Social media.
Yeah, actually, the name of the two people who have been shot and killed in the last couple of days are trending on social media, and that's hashtag Alton Sterling and hashtag Philando Castile. Now, both of these men passed away after getting shot by the police in Louisiana and Minnesota, respectively.
What are some of the things people are saying about the situation now? Just so two police shootings of black men so close together again.
There's a lot of disbelief, sadness, anger, and there are, you know, just protests in big cities like New York and Washington, D.C.
Any specific comments related to what has happened?
You know, a lot of big-name celebrities and, of course, politicians have weighed in. Bernie Sanders, especially, he has always been very outspoken on Black Lives Matter movements. He tweeted, "The violence that killed Alton Sterling and Philando Castile has become an all-too-common occurrence for people of color, and it must stop." And it's quite important that one of the most influential pop stars of our time, Beyoncé, shared a statement on her website, and she wrote, "It is up to us to take a stand and demand that they stop killing us."
Wow.
Powerful, yeah.
Very powerful, very powerful. This last shooting in Minnesota.
Right.
Because of the power of social media, because mm-hmm. of the fact that the man's fiance was able to stream this live on Facebook right after the man was shot, really shows the power of how quickly social media can really
right.
impact. I mean, who knows what would have happened if she was not able to do that.
And she actually said in one of the interviews she wanted this to go viral because she wanted to show what has happened, not through the eyes of the media, but through, you know, social media. And
through actually
so
what
far,
happened.
Yes. And within 20 hours since the video was streamed live, more than 4.1 million people have viewed it worldwide, and almost 300,000 people shared it on Facebook. Amazing reach.
Most definitely. I'm sure that will only continue to grow as the days go on.
And I also wanted to add that I added a poll on my Twitter page asking people, do you think her streaming it live was necessary or unnecessary? Because there are people who do say maybe she should have called 911 when she had the time to stream it live. Mm. And so far, 100% of the respondents answered that it was necessary. Lori?
All right. Thank you so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. tentatively approves flights to Cuba from 10 cities. The Islamic State group introduces gold currency in Iraqi, Syrian areas and Syrian areas it controls. Two women are competing for Britain's prime minister post. Conflict and cultural identity challenge Myanmar's education reform. And the Obama Presidential Library begins to take shape. For expanded coverage of these stories and much more, go to voanews.com or download our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Well, with less than 10 days to go before the Republican convention, Donald Trump met with House and Senate Republicans on Capitol Hill Thursday. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson was there, and she joins me now with an update. Catherine, so what was the main goal of Trump's visit?
In one word, his goal was unity. He has the Republican convention in Cleveland coming up in less than 10 days. He wants to solidify his support among House and Senate Republicans, let everyone know out in the broader general electorate that he has the support of his party, that they are behind him, and that everybody is on the same page, platform and policy-wise. That remains to be seen after the House Republicans came out of their meeting with him.
What do we know about that meeting?
A lot of people came out saying they were pleasantly surprised. We've heard a lot about how Donald Trump has this very different demeanor behind closed doors. Ben Carson very famously said that. And some people were kind of echoing that. They said he really, you know, commanded the room, that there was a good positive energy. They had a great policy discussion. Now, that was some of the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Other Republicans, who a lot of them were meeting him for the very first time, they mm-hmm. never had an opportunity to talk to him face to face, said that they were still on the fence.
Did they give any reasons why?
They said that they still had concerns about his controversial comments. Of course, he came into this meeting right after the new controversy over his comments about Saddam Hussein. We still have the ongoing discussion about his Star of David retweet. So those issues really follow Trump wherever he goes, just like the protesters. They were outside the Republican National Committee today, chanting at the House Republicans as they went into the meeting, saying Donald Trump is a bigot, Donald Trump hates Latinos, Donald Trump hates all of the different groups that he has said these incendiary things about.
I understand there's one lawmaker that is a member of the Never Trump Club that may have challenged him. What do you know about that?
So that's Jeff Flake, who, by all reports, got a little bit into it with Trump in this closed-door meeting. And Trump apparently challenged him and said that he wouldn't support Flake's reelection bid unless he went over to his side. And it sounded like Flake pushed back against that. I was over on the House side of things, and we were not hearing that same push and pull between members of the House and Donald Trump.
And I know that one of his former rivals, Senator Ted Cruz, was there, and they had a pretty ugly go of it during the campaign. What happened with those two?
So Ted Cruz actually has not yet released his delegates for the Republican convention, which is obviously a very smart move because that's his bargaining chip with Donald Trump. And it sounds like they may be moving towards some sort of deal. Ted Cruz has gotten a slot at the Republican convention to speak, and I'm sure he'll talk about his values that are important to him of constitutional conservatism. And possibly in return, he may be releasing his delegates to Donald Trump so that there's no minor threat that there could be a coup on the floor of the Republican convention to undermine Donald Trump.
How did it wrap up with Donald Trump on Capitol Hill?
I would say that if there was any general theme coming out of these meetings with Donald Trump, it's what we've heard in meetings before. Better Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton. You know, the nominee may say some things that they're uncomfortable with, but ultimately they want to make sure that they retain control.
All right. Thanks so much, Catherine. Well, also in Washington today, angry Republicans demanded answers from the chief of the Federal Bureau of Investigation about why he concluded there was no evidence to charge Hillary Clinton with misuse of classified material and emails while she was Secretary of State.
Did Hillary Clinton break the law?
In connection with her use of the email server, my judgment is that she did not.
James Comey said the decision was based on facts, not politics, and there was no evidence that Clinton clearly and willfully sought to violate U.S. laws.
And so when I look at the facts we gathered here, as I said, I see evidence of great carelessness But I do not see evidence that is sufficient to establish that Secretary Clinton or those with whom she was corresponding both talked about classified information on email and knew when they did it, they were doing something that was against the law.
FBI investigators found 113 classified documents in the more than 30,000 Clinton emails they reviewed from her tenure as Secretary of State. President Obama and other world leaders are meeting for the NATO summit in Poland for the next 2 days to discuss key security issues. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has that.
From Afghanistan to Ukraine to Islamic State, there's no shortage of global security threats to discuss at this year's NATO summit.
Well, let's be blunt. Alliances don't have a choice. They have to walk and chew gum. You don't prioritize key threats. You have to deal with all of them.
With U.S. troop numbers no longer an uncertainty, analysts say NATO leaders need a strategy to help Afghans solve a myriad of problems, including a struggling economy, a failure to restart peace talks with the Taliban, and a rise in Afghan casualties following a fierce fighting season.
It's not something where we are clearly losing, but whatever is happening there, we clearly are not yet winning.
To the south, NATO is not fighting the Islamic State as a bloc, with members choosing instead to send their troops unilaterally into the U.S.-led coalition. After the Paris terrorist attack last year, some called for NATO to invoke its Article 5 collective defense authorities against the extremist group. But some analysts warn against more NATO involvement.
I think NATO will not become officially involved in Syria and Iraq in a big way because we need Russian cooperation in Syria especially, and you're not going to get Russian cooperation if NATO is there.
Russia poses yet another potential threat to the alliance. Russia has illegally annexed neighboring Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula and has continued to support separatists in Ukraine's east.
On the deck below the bridge wing.
Russian pilots have also flown dangerously close to American warships, conducting training operations with NATO allies in the Baltic Sea. NATO leaders at the summit will need to both reassure NATO's eastern allies
below the bridge wing
and be ready to deter further Russian aggression. To help with this effort, the U.S., U.K., Germany, and Canada are each planning to lead a NATO rotational battalion to be based on the alliance's eastern flank. A U.S. official tells VOA President Barack Obama will announce that the U.S. will lead a battalion in Poland, with the others leading battalions in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Well, for the first time, the United States has put North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, on the U.S. sanctions list for human rights abuses. Joining me now for more on this, host of VOA's Asia Weekly, Steve Miller. Steve, thanks for being here. How unprecedented is this?
Well, I mean, this is the first time that the U.S. administration has named Kim Jong-un and really almost two dozen additional individuals, party officials and whatnot. But a lot of this goes back to 2014 and the United Nations Commission of Inquiry report. And this was a really scathing report on the human rights atrocities in North Korea, where they actually likened some of the conditions to Nazi-era prison camps.
That's pretty intense. So does this really impact him, or is it more for symbolic purposes?
Well, I wouldn't really say symbolic purposes. A lot of individuals that are in the human rights community say that this is a very important step that really highlights the atrocities that North Korea is committing inside their borders and hopefully bring about more pressure against Kim Jong-un and his government.
So is it possible to have some sort of effect?
It's too soon to see. There have been other notions and information shared in the past. And right now, there's one estimate anywhere between 80 and 120,000 political prisoners still in North Korea. And we really don't see that kind of shift changing anytime soon.
So can anything stop the reclusive regime from doing what it's doing regarding developing nuclear weapons and, you know, saber-rattling throughout the world?
Well, that's a question that analysts are really struggling to answer effectively. There's some analysts that say that the right course of action is to increase sanctions. Daniel Pinkston over at Troy University in Seoul says that the increased sanctions puts a political price, an economic price on North Korea that makes it more expensive for them to carry out these activities, while other analysts say, well, perhaps it's time to rethink and look at an arms control type point of view to try and manage the situation differently.
The regime is always very defiant and doesn't really seem to ever respond in a positive way to any of these types of actions. What has the response been so far?
Well, North Korea has called it a declaration of war, which is actually a pretty typical response from the Kim regime and North Korea in general. Anytime someone says something negative about North Korea, they will lash out in various ways. One of the common phrases when dealing specifically with South Korea is that they'll light up Seoul like a sea of fire. So this kind of response is something that we've seen time and time again.
So it's basically more of the same on both sides.
More of the same on both sides.
That was host of VOA's Asia Weekly, Steve Miller. Thanks so much, Steve. And we do have some breaking news coming into our studios at this hour. With Americans across the country outraged over police shootings, we are learning that a Black Lives Matter protest in Dallas, Texas has turned deadly. Three police officers have been killed, seven others wounded. Police now are in surgery, three of them in critical condition. So far, no suspects in custody. Again, multiple police officers killed during a Dallas protest. Police and transit officials are confirming the suspects now being hunted down. And finally, in a segment where we would normally bring you entertainment news in light of the sadness over the police shootings and violence in the United States, a report on someone whose life work has been about love. On September 4th, the Vatican will hold a ceremony to canonize Mother Teresa, the Roman Catholic nun and missionary of Albanian descent whose work to help the poor of Calcutta, India, and ease their suffering earned her numerous honors, including the Nobel Peace Prize. As VOA's Laura Conda reports, Mother Teresa was a humble person with an unlimited capacity to offer unconditional love to all.
When the people are hungry for a loaf of bread, a real hunger, but there is much deeper, much greater hunger, and that is the hunger for love.
Giving comfort to the suffering, offering shelter to the homeless, and helping the poorest of the poor was Mother Teresa's life work. Aniza Gonje Boyajiu was born on August 26, 1910, the third child of Albanian parents in Skopje, Macedonia. She was raised in a middle-class family, and at 18 decided to become a nun. She joined the Loretta Order first as a student and then as a teacher at a Roman Catholic girls' school in Calcutta, India. Professor Gzim Alpion says she later left her teaching post to devote her life to working among the poor in the slums of the city and to start a new order, Missionaries of Charity.
Mother Teresa from the beginning said that not only she didn't want money from the Vatican, but that she and whoever would follow her would live on charity. This was a new vision that Mother Teresa was, in a sense, putting in practice by working in the poorest areas of Calcutta.
Mother Teresa had to fight hard, first with the authorities of the Roman Catholic Church to get permission for her humanitarian work, and then with locals in India who thought her mission was to spread Christianity. But they soon realized she wanted nothing more than to live among the poor and ease their suffering. Mother Teresa's work reflected a unique philosophy of life.
There are two sides of Mother Teresa, if you like. The religious aspect of her work, as well as the humanitarian aspect. Both of them are linked together, and Mother Teresa had the ability to express her philosophy of life through simple words, but which have, if you like, a deep philosophical meaning.
Mother Teresa was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1979. At the ceremony, she spoke of the joy of spreading peace, of loving one another, and of the joy in acknowledging that the poorest of the poor are our brothers and sisters. In 2003, Mother Teresa was beatified by Pope John Paul II. She will be canonized by Pope Francis at the Vatican on September 4th of this year. The head of the Archdiocese's Convention of Albania, Archbishop Angel Masafra, calls the canonization a great honor.
That a small woman physically, but in fact a great person, who has been called the mother of humanity of the world, becomes a saint.
The Missionaries of Charity, the organization she created with only 20 nuns at the beginning, today has extended its activities in 130 countries, with more than 4,500 sisters who offer free service to the poorest of the poor. For VOA News, Laura Conda, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. We are glad you could join us. Find us anytime at voanews.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Follow me at Lori London. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Howie Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, the world is witness to the greatest refugee crisis since the end of the Second World War, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Samantha Power. And because it is global in scale, anything less than a global response will fall short of addressing it, she said.
Yet rather than spur a united front, a united effort, the challenge of mass displacement has divided the international community and even individual nations, leaving the lion's share of the response to a small number of countries, stretching our humanitarian system to its breaking point and putting millions of people in dire situations at even greater risk.
Obviously, the best way to resolve the crisis is to address the conflict, violence, and repression that is forcing people out of their homes. But in the meantime, we must do more to help, not only for their sake, but for our own security and stability. First, we must meet the vital needs of refugees in the present. Here we are coming up far short, said Ambassador Power. We are seeing record shortfalls in providing essential humanitarian assistance. In 2015, the UN requested approximately $20 billion to provide life-saving aid, only $11 billion of which was funded. This year, the $21 billion that the UN is seeking is less than one quarter funded. And second, we must offer refugee or resettlement to the displaced. By relying on a few countries to bear a disproportionate share of the cost of the crisis, the lives of many refugees are put at risk and may fall prey to violent extremists and members of organized crime. In recognition of the urgent need for all countries to do more, President Obama is convening on September 20th the Leaders' Summit on Refugees on the margins of the 71st UN General Assembly. In addition, the United States is also taking steps to increase our humanitarian aid to refugees and increasing the number of refugees we will resettle in the United States. We call on our friends and partners to follow our lead for the sake of the displaced and the global community.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for, what's